two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
I think we're going to have a surge of infection in the fall. It's not going to be anywhere near like the peak of last winter. If you look at the modeling's predicting at the peak, there'll be about 20% of the number of infections that there were at the peak of the January wave that we saw.
So tens of thousands, 50,000, something like that?
Well, you know, 50,000, 40,000 infections a day. Yeah. You know, if you believe the modeling, but it's going to be, as I said, hyper-regionalized. It's going to be parts of the country where there's very low levels of infection and parts of the country where there's more pervasive spread.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm your host, Andy Slavitt. That was Scott Gottlieb, the former head of the FDA from this episode. You're in for a real treat. This is probably the most essential of all the episodes of our season so far. It is one you absolutely cannot miss any word of. Scott is that good. Scott is probably the person that brings together the best scientific mind, the best political mind, the best policy mind, and he's someone who, like me, gets all of his information directly by observing, by talking to people, by being in the flow. And he's actually on the board of Pfizer, which gives him a leg up on some of the scientific information. Unlike me, Scott is a real scientist and a physician, so he brings you a lot of real firsthand perspective and opinion that I simply can't. And so this is going to be, I think, a wonderful episode where we focus on the facts of where we are in fighting COVID-19, the science of fighting COVID-19 in a way that I think everybody can understand. It is a critical piece of the puzzle for all of us. You know, as we get to week three, we should be leaving week three of this series with a feeling of kind of where we are as much as one can know it. And Scott lays it out for us great from soup to nuts. After listening to this, I expect you'll have the best possible baseline of information, and that'll allow us to go on to some other topics. And when I say of the best possible baseline, that will be until you read the quote, new study with the jolting headline. Undoubtedly, you're seeing them every day or two. It's a headline that's surprising. Because it just sends us all back reeling a little bit to question, oh no, are we headed back into the crisis we just left? And it is really disturbing, and it can get to us any day. Anytime we see a headline which, you know, may show something that implies that the vaccines don't work, or that a variant is gaining traction, or, you know, Lambda or J&J or this or that, and it shakes their confidence, because, you know, we're all quite a bit scarred from the last year, including me. So, you know, we all see these headlines, and they have this potential to throw us off our course. So my sermon today is actually on what to do when you see this single new study, this headline that potentially throws you off your course. And of course, it's very tempting to react to it. We have three basic choices, though. The first is, you know, get on Twitter and kind of relish in the panic. Just read people pushing it around, jumping to conclusions, telling us what it means, and just, you know, you have a really crappy day if you do that. And, you know, that's one of the temptations. There's a second option, which is to just ignore it. You know, put your head in the sand and say, it doesn't exist. I'm not going to let it get to me. You know, and the truth is, it's not the worst strategy in the world, to be honest, at all times. In large part because you can't carry around every burden that's not going to hit you. You can't carry it all around as a potential worry. You just can't. So sometimes, you know, it does make sense to just ignore it. There's a third choice, which I think is obviously the best choice, which is actually wait and let it ripen. I mean, these studies are like, you know, they're like green bananas. You don't want to eat them right away. Just wait for the questions to get asked and answered, which allows whatever it is to be put into context, and which I assure you will be much more reasonable and easy to understand. And of course, on In the Bubble, we will try to help you try to do that, but others will as well. And I think, you know, it takes a little bit of discipline to wait. But let me give you a current example that is fresh today. You know, there's a new study out from Israel. It's not even a study. It's a headline which says that the vaccination success rate is from Pfizer's dropped from like 90% to 65%. And that's jaw-dropping on its face. And it's something that would be upsetting to people if indeed it were true. And, you know, indeed, people are reeling from it. Now, I saw this and I got a hold of Tony Fauci. I got a hold of Rochelle Walensky. I got a hold of several other people just to gather some facts. And, you know, the truth is that you really don't know much of anything from looking at this one green banana. First of all, it says 60%. We don't know whether that's 10 people, whether that's 5 people, whether it's 100 people. And all of that matters. The second thing is it talks about largely that it is asymptomatic spread that is gone from, you know, this sort of 90% range to the 65% range. So this means that we are finding that there's more people who have been vaccinated and who haven't been vaccinated who are testing positive for asymptomatic spread. Okay, interesting. But what Dr. Fauci told me was that they are now in Israel testing virtually everybody that is in contact with someone who tests positive for COVID-19. So it stands to reason that if you're going to be testing more people that are in contact with people from COVID-19, you're going to find more people with some sort of with dormant conditions. Okay, but what about this bit about how the higher percentage of people that they're finding are people that have been vaccinated? That clearly must be troubling, right? That can't be good news. Although, it turns out, as Fauci explains to me, the very simple fact that in Israel, a larger percentage of people have been vaccinated means it absolutely has to be true, that more people who they find are positive are going to be vaccinated. But it says nothing about the effectiveness of the vaccine. It's a scary headline, maybe from a reporter or someone else who just noted the fact, but it just absolutely doesn't mean anything. It's like saying that we're finding that if in the NBA, more tall people are getting COVID-19 than in the regular population. Just are more tall people in the NBA. So that is not at all concerning. So there's a couple of things that are possibilities that we're going to find out about from this study. One is, if it indeed is true, and the numbers, the 60% number that they're talking about, the 65% number, differs pretty significantly from what we're seeing in almost every other country, which shows numbers that are in 80%, 90%, 90% plus. The other thing we don't know is whether or not this could mean that if it is true, that for certain populations, the length of the vaccine, the durability is beginning to wane a little bit. That's a possibility. We would expect that when the vaccine begins to wane its durability, we will first see it in Israel, since Israel was the first place where people were have been vaccinated. So the Israeli Health Ministry is meeting this week, and they're going to discuss whether or not it is indeed time to begin, particularly with the elderly population, to provide a third booster. So that conversation will happen. And that's a conversation that's going to happen eventually at some point anyway. And when it does, it'll come out of data from Israel. Is this that time? We don't know. It could be. It could be not. But when you add all of this up, what it tells you is, for one, it doesn't definitively tell you anything about what's going on with the effectiveness of the vaccine. It tells you something about the fact that more people in Israel are vaccinated. Doesn't tell you how many. We don't know how many people of this increase are because they're just testing many more people that come in contact with people with COVID. So none of these things are part of the context. As of today, the teams of people in the CDC are talking to the people in Israel, and all those questions are being answered. And so we will find out one way or the other. But there are lots of good explanations other than the panic-inducing explanation that comes from this headline. So it's a great example on how we shouldn't allow ourselves to get knocked off course so easily. It's a great example of how it sometimes makes sense to just let this information ripen. It's probably not nearly as significant as the headline implies. And of course, if there is something wrong, then we will learn about what this change means, and we will learn whether or not it means we need to change course with our vaccines. And of course, if it makes us feel better, we can always begin to take more precautions just in case. We can wear a mask if it makes you feel better indoors, an N95 mask. We can be careful and cautious around people that haven't been vaccinated or have immune deficiency issues. We can do all those things as wise coping mechanisms, but doesn't mean that we have to lose our cool, that we have to panic, or that we have to put ourselves in a situation where we're kind of replaying the tapes from last year and feeling very much out of sorts, like we're going to go through some of the same trauma again. It absolutely doesn't mean you have to put yourself through that. Okay? So that's, I think, what I want us to take away as much as everything else. Try to take things in stride. Don't get knocked off course by a single study and get the facts. And so with that, I am really happy to talk about all of the things we know and the things we suspect with one of the smartest people around, Scott Gottlieb. So here's Scott.
Hi, how are you? Let me close this door just in case the dog barks again. I'm sorry.
Ivan will appreciate that.
Okay, I'm set.
I want to get to your book. I actually find doing interviews easy. I find doing book interviews really hard for some reason. Like, I play back the interviews I do on like any normal topic on the pandemic or healthcare, and my answers are reasonably tight, and it's not like I know what I'm talking about. When I get asked about the book, my answers are terrible.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing you say that. I feel the same way when I talk about the book, because there's so much in there and so broad. And you know, you as the author, you don't want to you don't want to condense your book down to a single line. Like, my book's bigger than that. How can I talk about my book in a soundbite?
Exactly. No, like, people will say, like, you know, your book really talks about what's going on in the Trump administration. I'm like, yes, but not just that. It talks a lot about, you know, society and this and this and this people. And it's the worst interview known to man, because, you know, you're supposed to give a tight answer. And you know that. You know you're supposed to give a tight answer, but I can't seem to do it. So I listened to myself on being interviewed by Frist.
I saw that, yeah.
On PBS, and it was the worst. I was like, I've never seen a more boring person than that guy, like, talking about his book right now. Yeah, I describe myself in my book, probably bragging a little bit more than I should have, as one of the only Democrats that talked to the Trump administration regularly. You're one of the only Republicans I know who talks to the Biden White House on a pretty regular basis.
You know, I've been in touch with Congress and the administration all through this. I mean, one of the more memorable days for me was early on in March, probably around maybe March 12th. I talk about it in the book, but I forget the exact date. I spent the morning on Capitol Hill briefing the Republican conference, the Republican Congressional Conference. So all the Republican congressmen were crowded into a room. Liz Cheney had invited me to speak to them. It was right before the CARES Act was going to come before Congress, and she was trying to build support to get that passed. And I gave a pretty downbeat assessment about where I think things were heading. This was before, New York shut down. It was before there were a lot of cases turned over in New York. So we were right at the cusp of being aware of how much spread was underway in the United States. The only visible reminder that there was risk during that meeting was the breakfast was grab and go. So instead of a buffet line, which they usually had, they had someone serving the coffee and you had to grab your breakfast sandwich because they didn't want people touching shared utensils. And then that afternoon, I went and briefed the House Progressive Caucus. Congressman Pocan, others had invited me to brief the Progressive Caucus. It was sort of an eye-opening day. I went from briefing some of the most conservative members of Congress to briefing some of the most liberal members of Congress. And the one sort of pervasive emotion through, the morning and the afternoon was fear. I mean, there was sort of a palpable sense of fear and uncertainty, more uncertainty. A lot of the questions that, were focused on what was going to happen, how much risk were we in. That was a very memorable day. I mean, that really sort of crystallized for me moving across both sides of the aisle.
Well, that was a day when we were all Americans. I remember very explicitly when we were scared, we were all Americans. Unfortunately, that didn't last.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where Cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's get into some of the things that are most on people's minds right now. We are entering the summer months, and on the one hand, if you look back to where we were in January, we've come an extraordinary distance. Still, we're at a place where only 2/3 of adults have had their first shot. So on a scale of 1 to 10, if last March you were a 10 in terms of worry, where are you now?
Yeah, look, I'm probably a 5, but I think that understates the level of concern, because in the near term, I don't have a lot of concerns. I think that we're going to have a comfortable summer. I think, infection levels probably aren't going to start to build from this new variant, the Delta variant, until we get into maybe August, September, except for certain parts of the country where it's becoming epidemic now, certain parts of the rural South. But I do think we face risk heading into the fall. And the bottom line is this: 85% of the American population is going to develop immunity to SARS-CoV-2. We now have a choice of how we acquire that immunity. We can do it through vaccination or we can do it through natural infection. But the reality is, with this more contagious variant, when you look at Delta, at least 85% of the population is going to have to develop immunity before this stops spreading, given how contagious it is. And while vaccination rates are high, they're not evenly dispersed across the countries. There are still pockets of extreme vulnerability where we're going to see dense outbreaks at some point, probably heading into the fall.
So, okay, you say five. Let me ask you to split that into regions then. For people who live in Vermont, what's your level of concern for over the next few months?
It's low. It's two. It's low. Okay. Connecticut, same. I'm in Connecticut. High vaccination rate, a lot of immunity from prior infection, which we can't discount. So far, these new variants don't appear to pierce prior immunity. We also have a lot of immunity in the population from people who've been infected. But when you move to Missouri or even Ohio, Arkansas, Alabama, where vaccination rates are low, and we probably don't have quite as much infection, especially in rural parts of those states, my concern is very high.
Okay, let's take it to the individual level. We did it regionally. If you've been double vaccinated, how worried should you be about life in general? Let's just say over the next few months going, you know, through the summer, no matter where you live, how worried should you be on a scale of 1 to 10?
I think if you've been vaccinated, your chance of a very bad outcome are extremely low. Your chance of developing severe disease requiring hospitalizations, your chance of succumbing to COVID, dying from COVID are extremely low. You know, there's still a risk that you could contract the infection, become mildly infected, or even become asymptomatic and transmit the infection. But that's substantially reduced too. As you know, that was the basis for CDC lifting the recommendation around vaccinated people wearing masks, a recognition that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to transmit the infection. So I think if you're fully vaccinated, your risks are low. I do believe that, you know, based on the data I've seen, and this is public data, that, you know, the immunity acquired through vaccination is going to decline over time, particularly for older people. People who are more vulnerable don't have as robust of an immune response to begin with. So I do think that at some point, we're probably going to want to provide boosters to a certain segment of the population who are at higher risk of COVID and for whom the vaccines may not have the same durability. But for most people who get vaccinated, I think they're going to have a durable response, and the risks from COVID are substantially reduced.
Okay. And I'd love to come back and talk a little bit about the fall and boosts and so forth. But as far as the summer's concerned, if you've been vaccinated, is your main message, you know, enjoy your summer, you've got low risks. There's obviously exceptions if you're immunocompromised or for kids or if you got kids at home, there's some adjustments perhaps that need to be made. But just holding those off for the time being, generally speaking, you've been vaccinated, you've gone through a year of hell. Here you are in the summer. Would you go so far as to say, even, God forbid, enjoy yourself?
I think that's right. I would tell people to enjoy themselves this summer. I mean, I made the comment on TV that it's going to be like Woodstock across America this summer. I think people, there's a lot of, pent up desire to go out, vacation, spend time with family. I think people should do it. I think we have an opportunity to do it. Infection levels are going to be low in most parts of the country. I think they're going to remain low. If you look at the modeling for the outbreaks that we're anticipating in the fall, sort of right around back to school from 617 from this new Delta variant, some states show no uptick at all of infections. Other states show raging epidemic. So it's going to be hyper-regionalized in terms of which parts of the country are affected. And I don't think it's going to be like last year, where in the fall of 2020, you saw dense outbreaks in the Midwest. It really started in the Midwest, if you remember. Wisconsin was, you know, lit up with infection, and it was mostly rural parts of Wisconsin. And then the infection became national. I don't think that that's going to be the case this time, where you have a regionalized epidemic in certain states, and then it sort of grows into a national epidemic. I do think that there's going to be parts of the country that are largely impervious. I mean, impervious might be an aggressive word, but are going to be largely impervious to epidemic spread of COVID, unless something unexpected happens. And there's one variant. So Delta isn't just one variant. Delta is really five variants, as you know. There's one version of it, one strain. People call it sort of Delta Plus, that when you look at the experimental evidence, the vaccines don't appear to cover it as well. It seems to pierce the vaccines. And this is based on, you know, experiments done in test tubes, where you're looking at the ability for antibodies produced by the vaccine to neutralize the virus in petri dishes. So we don't have clinical evidence to sort of support that, but there is concern the vaccines may be less effective against that particular strain.
When I fly, I try to get upgraded to Delta Plus usually.
It's pretty bad, Andy. So,
no, this show has the best dad jokes. that you've ever heard. And it's well known. I mean, most people listen for the really high quality humor like that. You're kind to laugh. Most don't. Most roll their eyes, but you're very kind to laugh. So let's move to the fall. Let's talk about the fall and the winter. You give it a good outlook on the summer, particularly if you're vaccinated and by region. So what do you anticipate? Like if you're watching the news, if you're watching CNN or NBC or CBS, and you know, we know the anchor comes on at the beginning and says, well, COVID, we have an outbreak. Are you anticipating like lots of outbreaks, lots of small outbreaks? Are you anticipating something that looks a little like 2020? What do you think the fall will look like?
I think we're going to have a surge of infection in the fall. It's not going to be anywhere near like the peak of last winter. If you look at the modeling is predicting at the peak, there'll be about 20% of the number of infections that there were at the peak of the January wave that we saw.
So tens of thousands, 50,000, something like that?
Well, you know, 50,000, 40,000 infections a day. Yeah. You know, if you believe the modeling, but it's going to be, as I said, hyper-regionalized. There's going to be parts of the country where there's very low levels of infection and parts of the country where there's more pervasive spread. I think those models are a little bit aggressive, quite frankly. I don't know that it's going to be that bad. I wouldn't be surprised to see 40 or 50,000 infections recorded on some days as we get into the fall and we're sort of in the peak of a surge of infection. But I think it's probably going to be a little bit lower than that, but very concentrated in certain parts of the country where there's low levels of vaccination, not a lot of prior immunity from prior infection. This is if the Delta variant becomes prevalent, which it seems to be. I think with Delta plus, the one that appears to pierce vaccination, if the current strand Delta becomes pervasive across the US, it should crowd that out. The immunity that people acquire through the current from the current strain should be protective against other forms of the Delta variant.
Do you see Delta plus? Could Delta plus outcompete Delta?
It isn't. So that's a good suggestion that it won't. But always, you know, obviously always hard to tell. I think at some point there's going to be a recommendation from CDC around boosters for a certain segment of the population. It's probably going to be for people who are above a certain age and, you know, out a certain length of time from completing their original vaccine series. So, you know, I think a recommendation would look something like, if you're over the age of 65 and you're more than 9 months, 10 months out from completing your vaccine, your original vaccine, you should get a third dose. Maybe it's 60, maybe it's 55, maybe it's 12 months, maybe it's 8 months. I'm not sure. But if you look at the data out of Denmark and other nations have done a good job tracking natural infection, the immunity acquired through natural infection, it does show in the older population a decline, and a substantial decline, and it's very age dependent. So the Danish study, Danish landmark study, which looked at people who had infection after a significant interval, at I think 7 or 8 months, overall protection from people who were infected was still 80%. So still really good for the population as a whole, a lot of residual immunity. But if you looked at the cohort 65 and above, it was only 47%. So a substantial decline in the older cohort. So if you want to maintain protection from infection above 50%, I think you're going to want to get boosters. Now, that said, there's probably, and the studies came out just in the last few days looking at this, there's probably a complement of residual immunity from T cells and memory B cells where the vaccines are inducing a longer term immunity and protecting you against severe disease. So that means that you might be more likely to get infected after a year. Let's say you get vaccinated a year later, you might be more likely to get infected. Your antibody levels have come down. So you might only have 50% of your original protection against infection, but you're going to have other immune cells that protect you against severe disease, protect you against hospitalizations, protect you against death.
Does that mean you're contagious?
It means you could be contagious too. Yeah. So, but if the goal is to protect people from infection in part, so they never get infected in the first place, because, you know, infection is obviously uncertain. Some people will have bad outcomes and you want to reduce the likelihood that they're going to then transmit the infection. You want to maintain their protection above 50%. That's sort of a threshold that you want to maintain above. And to do that in an older population, you're probably going to need to provide boosters.
So what I'm hearing you say, big picture, is COVID's not gone, but we have the tools. The tools aren't being used perfectly, but we have the tools to effectively make COVID a manageable challenge for the country now, which is an enormous difference than where we were, which was an emergency and kind of a runaway train. So just to test that a little bit, to make sure that I said that right, do you anticipate overflowing hospitals in certain communities?
No, I think that the death and disease, the morbidity and mortality from infection is going to be substantially reduced. And look what's happening in the UK right now. 90,000 Delta infections, 93,000 based on their last release. They've had about 1,000 hospitalizations. Only 8% of the hospitalizations have been people who are fully vaccinated. You know, if you look at deaths of those under the age of 50, there's been no deaths in people under the age of 50 who've been fully vaccinated. It's a little hard to look at over the age of 50 because most of the people over the age of 50 have been vaccinated. So they're going to be breakthrough infections. People who are over the age of 50 and get infected with Delta are breakthrough infections. They're people who've been vaccinated and get infected. But when you look at under 50.
But are they single or double vaccinated?
I'm talking about fully vaccinated.
Okay.
So the case fatality rate in the UK right now, if you look at the data, is anywhere from, you know, 0.2 to 0.3%. If you look at sort of a 28-day mortality, that's substantially reduced from where we were, right? And it's probably going to come down a little bit more. So we're not quite at the level of mortality caused by flu, but you're starting to approach flu. I mean, everyone said COVID was flu a year and a half ago. COVID clearly wasn't flu. But at some point, the level of risk that COVID poses societally in terms of hospitalizations and deaths is going to start to approach what we see from seasonal influenza. And I think when you get to that point, this becomes a manageable threat. The healthcare system can manage it. And in its, you know, quite frankly, a decision individuals start to make about how they want to acquire their immunity. Because like I said at the outset, 85, maybe more percent of us will develop immunity to COVID. One way or the other, we will develop immunity to COVID. Some of us will have to acquire that multiple times. People now have a choice.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember the data that during bad flu season, like the number of daily deaths is like, what is 100 or a couple of hundred?
It was about 100 at the peak of the flu season. That's
about 100. And so, you know, just to compare, COVID is, you know, between 2 and 3 times that right now, come down from substantially more, from 30 times more, or close to even 35 times more. But it's not there yet. One of the interesting differences is the flu has a very kind of spotty vaccine, and COVID has a very well-functioning, highly functioning, effective vaccine. So one would think that as particularly the people that are most vulnerable, which are going to be, you know, start with seniors, are vaccinated, that we could be down in that range at some point or lower. I mean,
well, we're probably closer to that range right now. A lot deaths are a lagging indicator, not only because the deaths that are occurring today are infections that occurred, you know, a while ago, but we record deaths from death certificates, and it takes a long time for that information to actually be aggregated. So the if you sort of project out deaths that will occur as a result of infections happening now, it's substantially lower than what we're recording on a daily basis. So
that's a good point. So I like you. You're smarter than me. I think this is consistent with my thesis, which I don't know if you agree with or not, which is that COVID is becoming a manageable challenge. We have tools. It's not going away, but it's no longer in the bucket. I mean, I'm thinking about the average person sitting home saying, the last year's felt really out of control. We didn't really have the tools to deal with this other than adjustments in our own behavior, which run into limitations. And of course, we can all control our own behavior. We can control other people's behavior. And we lost a lot of things. And the sort of focus is like of the question of most people have, which is when, is it okay for me to be back to normal? And I think a lot of my answer depends on a lot of people's definitions of normal are going to be different. But that with some exceptions for people whom the vaccine doesn't work well for, and I want to talk about that in a second. You know, we're living in a place where this is one of many manageable challenges in life, not something that overwhelms us. Would you agree with that characterization?
I would agree with the characterization that for most people, COVID is an addressable threat and a manageable challenge, with the one caveat that there's still pockets of extreme vulnerability that we need to recognize and address, because it's not manageable for everyone. Right. You know, there's still issues with people who the vaccine hasn't been accessible. or face challenges getting vaccinated. There's still people who, you know, are scared of getting vaccinated and need better counseling, better information. And there's still people for whom the vaccine is not going to work.
That's right. I agree with that, that caveat. I don't know, but you in graduate school, there was always the person who you made a smart comment, then the person raised their hand and then made a smarter comment on top of your comment. And you're like, that guy always does it to me.
That was better. That joke was better than your Delta Plus.
The Delta, I think the Delta Plus is the winner.
Is that going to be the excerpt that you guys use on Twitter?
I doubt it. But let's talk about because Pfizer is actually doing something. And I want to talk about the next potentially exciting breakthrough for just a minute, because people are talking about thinking about vaccines nonstop, but an oral antiviral.
Yeah, we don't think about it, but you're right.
So can you talk about the potential, the likelihood, and the impact of an oral antiviral?
Yeah, so there's a number of products in advanced development right now. Merck has one that looks very promising, put out data about 11 days ago. There was a preprint about 2 weeks ago, and that's in advanced development. That's a drug that they licensed from a company called Ridgeback. Roche has a drug that works on the same mechanism as the Merck drug, generally speaking, but it's earlier. There's a drug by Fuji that was originally developed for flu that's being put in a very large trial looking at potential efficacy against COVID. And then there's the drug by Pfizer, which is a protease inhibitor. Obviously, I'm on the board of Pfizer. You know that. I think a lot of the listeners know that. All the drugs work by basically inhibiting some aspect of viral replication. The Pfizer drug inhibits protease, an enzyme that the virus uses to replicate. These drugs look promising. I think people are cautiously optimistic at Pfizer about the compound that the company is advancing. The government's reached in, as you know, and you were part of this, and has partnered with the companies on some of the development, helping to run the clinical trials. They've agreed to some advanced purchase agreements. I think this could be a real game changer. I think if we can get a drug that inhibits viral replication, that's safe, that's largely non-toxic, that can be used on an outpatient basis, both to treat people who are exposed to the virus and at risk of a bad outcome. So as a prophylaxis in people who might be at high risk of a bad COVID outcome and know that they've come in contact with COVID, so a sick contact in a house, something like that, as well as to be administered early in the course of the infection to prevent progression to severe disease, that could be a real game changer. We don't even think about it, and yet we could potentially have it by the late fall,
a
sort of Tamiflu-like drug for COVID.
Yes. Do you anticipate a day when you will be able to, have a family member walk into a drugstore, pick up something that is like Tamiflu, and if you're feeling symptomatic, and just take it and boom?
Yeah, we will have that. The reason I feel optimistic, and I can't say for sure it's going to be one of these drugs, right? We don't know. But there's nothing so highly intricate about the way coronavirus replicates that we can't drug it. All the machinery that this virus uses to replicate, we've drugged in other contexts. This isn't HIV. This isn't sort of a wily, very difficult to drug virus. This is a fairly straightforward virus. The only reason we don't have a drug for coronavirus now is normally coronavirus causes very mild illness. And so there was never really a sort of public health imperative to develop a drug to target a seasonal coronavirus that causes a seasonal cold in most people. But this is a druggable target. We should be able to find a way to inhibit viral replication. Now, that said, it's not going to be a cure-all. I mean, even using a drug in early disease to prevent replication as a way to prevent progression, it's not going to work for everyone. Just like Tamiflu doesn't reduce symptoms for everyone and doesn't prevent sort of flu illness even when used early, but it will work for a lot of people if you have a potent drug. And I think beyond that, it's going to really improve psychology around COVID. If people know that there's a pill that can help rescue them or prevent them from getting seriously ill, I think it's going to make people feel far more confident around living a normal life against the backdrop of COVID circulating at some level in society.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great point on the psychology. It does feel like, and in particularly, I'm thinking about immunocompromised, immunosuppressed people, people who can't take a vaccine for one reason or another, having another answer out there. And you're talking about the fall when we'll see results from these trials, and we could be, you know, very quickly, with a little bit of luck, these things could be into the market, into our hands.
And keep in mind, I mean, just to pick up on your point, if you have a drug that's has a good safety profile, for some people, they might take it in perpetuity over a period of time to prevent infection. So, you know, if you're an immunocompromised person or someone for whom the vaccines don't work or you can't take a vaccine, and you have a drug that's largely safe and can be used as a prophylaxis, you might take it over the 2 months of peak COVID season. I mean, there are people who do that with Tamiflu now. Tamiflu is obviously approved for prophylaxis, but not for a month. But I know there are people who will take it for, you know, a month or two through a bad flu season because they're so vulnerable to flu and the vaccines don't work for them or they can't take the vaccines. So at least that option is available if you have a safe and effective drug for certain people.
That's interesting. And do you see it being a potential global aid? I mean, while we're trying to vaccinate the world, and we've got, you know, we're only 10 billion doses short of vaccinating the world at this point. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done there. But do you anticipate that while we're in the process of doing that, that this can be a tool that can, if this can get manufactured at enough scale, that it can help us around the globe?
Yeah, because it could be manufactured easily. You know, it's a small molecule drug. You can partner with a lot of different manufacturing sites globally and produce this in you know, potentially massive quantities. I do think that we're solving the, you know, slowly, obviously not at the speed that we need to, but we're starting to solve the global vaccine supply issue, including the work that you did. We've delivered 2.7 billion doses of vaccine globally. You know, we need to remember it's not just us and Western vaccines. China's also providing vaccine. Russia's providing vaccine. So when you start to aggregate all the vaccine supply that's going to be available over the next 12 months, it's more than enough to vaccinate the world. I mean, Pfizer alone is going to said that they're going to produce 4 billion doses. Moderna, I think 3 billion. You have J&J and AstraZeneca in the game. Sanofi is going to enter the market, I believe, at some point. Novavax looks like it's going to be a successful vaccine. And then you have the Russian and the Chinese vaccines. And India also is going to be manufacturing at significant scale.
And it's going to take the world because by every estimation I've seen, it's tens of billions of dollars. Even with the manufacturers not making a profit in the developing world and in the kind of medium wealth countries, it's still tens of billions of dollars. So it's going to take, you know, this is where I think the G7 and as you said, the G20 is going to lead.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to finish up with a couple of other quick topics. Bipartisanship, and I want to talk a little bit about your book, which I was lucky enough to have a chance to look at. You know, you mentioned earlier in the show that you've been called by both Democrats and Republicans to talk. You know, you and I, and I'm guessing you and other Democrats, have done things together. Do you think it's important to do that for some reason to show a Democrat and a Republican kind of working together, saying similar things?
In response to a public health crisis and a national security issue, absolutely. I don't think for us to be effective, our responses to these kinds of crises can be politicized. I don't think we can go forward with sharp political divisions on how we approach something like this, because then you can't get the consensus that you need in time to be able to have an effective response.
So you and I co-authored a letter together last year, and it was about contact tracing and some related topics and kind of containment. And then we had other people on the letter, Democrats and Republicans, both public health professionals. Do you think the fact that it came from the two of us and others changed the way it was received, as opposed to if it came from, say, Democrats only or Republicans only?
Look, absolutely, it changed the way it was received. I think there's no question about that. This became a challenge really early because you started to see sharp political divisions over how we should respond to this. And once those started to materialize, I think it eroded the ability to get the sort of public consent that you needed to implement the kinds of steps that we needed, the kinds of precautions that were needed. So this was a moment like a national security crisis. This was a moment where people needed to initially just come together and create a consensus on how we were going to respond. And we didn't do that. That set us back.
That eroded. I mean, our politics proved to be more powerful than our interest and concern for public health or for one another or for, pulling together. And it was an election year. Maybe that had something to do with it. It's a very divided country. Maybe that had something to do with it.
And maybe because it was a public health issue, and so it wasn't sort of perceived the same way, or maybe it was the uncertainty about the risk that it posed. And so people didn't sort of put it in that kind of bucket of stuff where they say, we just have to work together. Because, you think about it, after 9/11, the country came together. We did controversial things, but we agreed to do them. We debated it later, but initially we came together. Yep. You think even about the financial crisis in 2008, and the country came together, Democrats and Republicans came together to solve that crisis. It was highly controversial, and there was a lot of debate after the fact, but there was an initial response where there was a effort to do something on a bipartisan basis. We didn't really have that here. I mean, we had it around the CARES Act. There was clearly a political consensus around that, but we never formulated a consensus around what our initial response was going to be, what measures were needed. I mean, there may have been like a couple of weeks in there in the beginning, but it was very fleeting. And that might be because at a sort of political level and leadership level, a public health crisis isn't perceived in the same way as a national security threat, although it very much is. It poses the same risk to the country, but it's not kind of put in that bucket. That could be part of the challenge.
If Mitt Romney had been president instead of Donald Trump, do you think it would have been different?
Well, look, I think things certainly would have been different with different political leadership. There's no question about that. But I think that we make the mistake of trying, and I talk about this a lot in the book, and the book's very much focused on this. I think we make a mistake by looking at this through a lens of Trump or not Trump, or this political leader or that political leader. There were systemic problems with our response that are pervasive throughout the bureaucracy that under any president would have stymied an effective response. And we need to at some point get past looking at this just purely through the lens of the political leadership and the political mistakes that were made, and start looking, in my view, at those more systemic shortcomings, because that's what's going to make us vulnerable in perpetuity.
I agree with that, as my book lays out as well. But I also think there's, in an extraordinary moment, there is something that really requires leadership, empathy, politicians who are willing to see this crisis as something bigger than themselves, as opposed to just how it reflects on them. And I look at governors around the country of both parties who I've worked with and who you've worked with, and I watch them do that. Now, none of them, to your point, none of them had a perfect response. I mean, this was as I had a guest on, David Frum, who said something which I repeat all the time, which is, it's impossible to get an A in responding to a pandemic, but it's also really hard not to at least get a B. And to get a B, you need some matter of execution, empathy, and an effort to try to save lives. I don't think Donald Trump even got a B. So I think there's something about kind of populism and a pandemic response that doesn't fit very well about trying to avoid tough decisions and leadership and so forth. I mean, politicians want to be loved. I mean, that's why they go into politics. And making tough decisions is not easy for politicians of any stripe. Yet when I talked to world leaders in other countries, they had all the same challenges, but it didn't break down around political identity. And over, world leaders would tell me, I don't know how we would have even been able to respond if people broke down under political identity lines. In other words, people here don't love masks. Some people debate their effectiveness. Some people, you know, don't wear them. Some do. But it has absolutely nothing to do with political affiliation. And in your country, it seemed like, for whatever reason, it became kind of a matter of political identity. If I vote a certain way, then I've got to believe a certain thing about the pandemic.
If you look across the world, I mean, at least you look in sort of Western democracies, the measures were contentious. There was a lot of debate. There were protests around masks in other countries. There were protests around the mitigation, for sure. I mean, we saw that in Europe. I think it's probably a fair point that it didn't break down as cleanly in other nations along sort of political identity. There was definitely a break along ideological lines in other nations, but you're probably right that it didn't become encapsulated in sort of political identity, Republican versus Democrat, as it did here. But, you know, partly that probably also reflects the fact that our ideologies are very closely sort of aligned to our political identities in this country. Part of it may have been just sort of partisan leanings, but the debate occurred everywhere, I think, or at least in the West, it occurred everywhere.
No question.
Here, you're right. I think it broke down more along party political lines than it did in other nations.
No question. In Europe, I think the only other curveball I'd throw into that equation is that places that had experienced prior severe epidemics or pandemics responded with less division because they'd seen the horror of some of the prior pandemics or epidemics that had ravaged their country or that had threatened their countries. And so they responded with more uniformity.
Well, look at the Pacific Rim. So the countries of Thailand, Vietnam, Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, China, New Zealand, Australia. I think you can put the Philippines in there as well. I'm probably leaving out a few nations. When you look at the aggregate cases in the Pacific Rim, I looked at this in sort of the fall of 2020, they were registering in totality fewer daily cases in the city of Los Angeles. So an entire region of the world had figured out how to keep this virus at bay and still are largely keeping it at bay. So I think that there's definitely things that we could have done, definitely things we did wrong, and definitely things that other countries were able to achieve because they have a different level. And you talk about this in your book about, you know, social cohesion being a critical factor. It's people say the reason why South Korea was able to keep the infection out is because of their surveillance state. That was certainly one feature, but it was the testing, it was the tracing, it was people being willing to get tested. It was, you know, a sense of civic virtue that you didn't want to introduce the infection to a workplace or into a job site or into your family. You know, we have a situation here where the vaccine can prevent you from being a carrier of the virus and introducing it into a congregate setting. You know, why don't more people say to themselves, I'm going to get vaccinated because I want to protect the people around me. I don't want to be the person who goes to work and there's a vulnerable person at work and I'm the one who introduces the infection to that workplace and someone gets sick because of me. That should be a stronger sentiment around why we're promoting vaccine here. That's the kind of messaging that, you know, was very effective in South Korea, that it was sort of a, you know, agreeing to these public health measures was an act of civic virtue. You were doing it to protect the people around you, not just to protect yourself. Just like wearing masks, you're going to wear a mask to protect the people around you. It's not just about protecting you, it's about protecting others. That was part of what made them successful. And you talk about that a lot in your book.
Well, that's something you and I need to figure out how to fix next time, Scott. I mean, it's a challenge I'm going to lay at your doorstep and my own, because I do think you were an amazing example, and there were others, Mark McClellan, others, and I certainly tried at times, although I had my beefs with the Trump administration, and as I told the Trump administration, you know, I'm not going to be silent if I see you guys making big mistakes.
But this is where the leadership matters. You talk about the political leadership. I think this is where political leadership could have and would have made a critical difference, which it's not just about the execution. It's about galvanizing the public, about bringing people together around sort of a shared set of measures that we could have taken, that if we practiced them consistently, we would have had a better outcome.
Yeah. Maybe you and I could work on how to figure out how to, for the next go around, figure out how to take the politics out. I'm not sure I know the answer. You got a book coming out. I just want to close on that. I think people should be enormously excited to read it because you've got an informed point of view. You see all sides of it. You do what a lot of people don't. You express things with the appropriate amount of humility and caveats when required and with amount of confidence when you see the data that causes that. I think this book is one of the gifts that I think we will use to build on coming out of the pandemic. So I encourage people to pre-order it, but maybe spend a second on how you thought about that book coming together and what you wanted to accomplish with it.
Yeah, so the book is titled Uncontrolled Spread. I tried to do in the book what we've talked about here. I tried to look beyond, and I lay this out in the introduction, tried to look beyond just sort of the political narrative and look at the shortcomings in our response related to systemic failures. And so, challenges with the way CDC responded to the crisis. I think CDC needs to be fundamentally reformed. We don't really have an operationally minded agency capable of responding to a crisis of this magnitude. We should have learned that from past crises when we saw challenges with the response to H1N1, Zika, Ebola. I talk a lot about needing to look at public health preparedness through the lens of national security and how do we build better resiliency in our system in the United States so that we're better prepared for threats like this. So things like having a hot base capable of scaling testing and manufacturing of biologicals. So this is a book focused on identifying what went wrong and with a focus on the more systemic features of our failings and in how do we prepare better for the future. So it's a heavy policy book with a lot of recommendations about policy steps I think we need to take to build out better preparedness for the future.
I think you leave the book, if you read it, you leave the book smarter, better informed, and also I think emotionally with a greater sense that there are solutions and that there are smart people working on it, thinking about it. So I recommend it.
Yeah. Well, I think what, some of the insights from this book, I hope, that are going to make it unique are very detailed blow by blow of what went wrong with things like the development of the diagnostic test, with the rollout of the vaccines and the antibody drugs. And so I get into a lot of detail with what was going on inside the government during those episodes and places where I think we fell short. So I hope that there's some new insights that come out of this as well that help to identify the problems.
Yeah, I think it'll be a great read and thank you for the contribution. And I would love to have you agree to come back towards the end of this series. We're going to want to do a wrap up of kind of where do we stand on the science and where do we stand as a country. And would love to have you come back for that.
Be delighted to.
Thank you, Doctor.
Good to see you. All
right. You too, man. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks.
Terrific conversation with Scott. I plan on playing that one back for myself several times. I always learned so much with Scott, and we had a great conversation. In fact, it was probably about twice as long. And that's the edited version. But the common wisdom is that people don't want to listen to an hour and a half conversation between me and Scott. So we might have that in some other form, but we don't have it here to save you having to listen to Scott. And I talk for very long, but I do want to talk about what to expect next because on the show, because now we've been through 3 weeks worth of in the bubble, our shot, and we've gotten ourselves to a place where I think it's safe to say we've opened some questions and we've essentially put ourselves in a situation where we know as best we can, as best you can possibly know, kind of what's going on and that there will be some uncertainty and some ambiguity, but things are headed in the right direction. The worst is behind us and we know the state of the science and we know that occasionally things are going to happen that may try to knock us off our game, but we're going to try hard not to let that happen, or at least I am. So now we're going to cover a series of topics in the next coming weeks, one by one, that are, I think, critical components to where we are and where we go next. The next week is going to be a focus on those unvaccinated people here in the U.S., how to understand them, what to do about it, what it means, what the implications are, how to talk to people in those situations, etc. And we're going to have the people that helped me at the White House to come on the show and give us some really critical information Molly Brody from the Kaiser Family Foundation has done the best survey work to help us understand this group. And Frank Luntz, the political pollster, has conducted some amazing focus groups that were a big help to us in the White House to help us listen for the language and really understand what we're hearing from and what the needs are of people who haven't been vaccinated. And then Wednesday, a great conversation where we're going to go really break it down in a really interesting way with David Axelrod, who's one of the best kind of political commentators and social commentators around. So that will be week four. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Thank you so much for letting me be with you. And we will talk to you then. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax still rule our lives and executive produce the show. And our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media. And you can find me at aslavitt on Twitter or at andyslavitt on Instagram. If you like what you heard today, most importantly, please tell your friends to come listen. And please stay safe, share some joy, and we will get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jose Andres. Maybe you know me from my restaurants or maybe from Wall Central Kitchen, the organization I founded to feed people after disasters. Well, it's time for you to know my podcast, Longer Tables. Each episode, I get to know fascinating people in the most intimate way, through food. Stacey Abrams, Jojo Ma, Jane Goodall, Padma Lakshmi. I will answer questions from listeners too. Join me in building longer tables, not higher walls. Whatever you get your podcasts.